Welcome, welcome to Candy from Strangers. I'm Rebecca.
And I'm James.
And we're bringing you some candid talk where we aim to contemplate and journey through this life to hopefully help your day just taste a tiny little bit sweeter. Welcome back. We are going to finish this book review, Come Hell or High Water, The Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown. We are on our last three guideposts. Let's jump in.
Okay. Guidepost number 8, cultivating calm and stillness.
Yep. So step 1, she talks about lessening your anxiety. Easier said than done. Okay. So how? She's up front and she says right away that you can't rid yourself of anxiety. Obviously, you can't get rid of it. So one way to lessen it is by becoming aware. So just becoming aware of it helps lessen its power over you.
That's something that I'm working on, is like with awareness, figuring out what I can do to get rid of it or lessen the anxiety or manage it. And I wrote down a little note. It's like, to change, you cannot be the same. And it's like, it sounds stupid, but it's not reacting while you're anxious. It's not acting while you're anxious, but being aware that you're anxious and letting the moment pass. It's finding a place of calm in the middle of the anxiety.
So Brené was talking about how she did a bunch of research with people. During her interviews, she was discovering that people were not actually anxiety-free. They were just aware. And by being aware, they were committing to living this life where their anxiety was a reality, but it wasn't a lifestyle. It wasn't in control anymore. Because there's no real way just to get rid of it. It's going to be there as life, you know? So becoming aware of it allows us then to pivot and choose our next course. And I think it presents differently in everyone. So she talks about calm, and she does a really great definition on page 106.
Yeah, calm as creating perspective and mindfulness while managing emotional reactivity.
It sounds so simple, but that's huge.
Talking about managing the reactivity, calm isn't managing the reactivity. Calm is the perspective. And then you have to initiate the tools to manage your reactions and your emotional reaction.
Yeah.
I think that's separate. What I'm working through is when I'm experiencing anxiety issues, finding that calm, looking for what is the right tool to manage that emotional reactivity. Because sometimes my emotional reactivity is like an anger, sometimes it's fear, sometimes it's just weird paralysis. Like, I have to have a different tool to manage that reaction so that I don't fall into those traps of an unthinking emotional reaction.
Right. She talks about thinking about calm people. Like, have you ever come across somebody who just seems very self-possessed, like a calm person? You feel like you could tell them anything or they could experience anything and they're not going to flip out. Those people bring their quiet to the noise.
I know people that think that I'm the calm one in the room. And I'm like, I'm just trying not to freak out right now.
Well, it's contagious. So if you're having a panicky response, right, to a panic situation, you're not going to be able to get through the situation. They say that if you're in some sort of a crisis and you're screaming, like, your chance of survival is dramatically diminished.
I like that.
It's like a proven fact. I don't have my statistic, you know, charts with me, my proven facts, but I saw it on, you know, Dateline or something like that long ago. But if you can just keep a level head, just add a little bit of quiet, even though you're scared out of your freaking mind, you know, it doesn't have to be control, like absolute control, then your chances of survival raise exponentially. Of course, that's like, okay. I feel like that actually plays into my anxieties, because I tend to have like, okay, I have all these plans so that I'll be able to like solve a problem. But then I'm thinking about these horrible scenarios and then that makes me get anxious. So I don't know if that was actually helpful information. But Brené discusses how the panic response makes for more panic and fear because it's contagious. But here's the kicker. So is calm. Calm is contagious. Think of a crying baby. Oh, shush, shush, shush. You're shushing the baby and you're patting the baby and you're like, come on, be quiet. Oh, keep crying. That's great. Okay. And they're getting you riled up. It's not going to create any calm. But when you take the baby and you hold them to your chest, and even though they're crying, you just remain steady and you have a soft pat on their back, like a heartbeat pat on their back, it's like giving them your nervous system that's being calm to their dysregulated nervous system. You're literally sharing the calm. It's contagious. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was going to share a quote that they made me memorize once.
They,
my training cadre. So one of the Air Force training things that I went through, we learned a lot of quotes. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite, and I still have memorized, Vince Lombardi said this, confidence is contagious. So is lack of confidence.
Dang.
And that's what it's like when I read that about the contagion of attitude, reaction, it carries through in our tribal mentalities as humans and our familial ties. We feed off of the mentality of each other and the status that we set.
Our human connection, like the need to be part of a group, a tribe, if you will.
Right. We make those connections because we are social beings. We will mimic or learn from individual reactions. A calm individual as a leader, as a teammate, brings in calm to the team. It's the same thing with family.
Yeah, she mentions that if you didn't have calmness modeled for you, you know, as a child, that it's like it's really unlikely that that's going to be a response that you are used to having. And the best way to learn to do that is practice. But first, you have to be aware. So the anxiety awareness, right? To identify what exactly are the emotions and things that make you spark reactivity and practice non-reactive responses. And I love it in here. She's talking about these different after-school specials. And these parents were like throwing things and like yelling. And they were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you would do this and blah, blah, blah. And then she goes, and then they go, okay, I think we're ready. And then they went to go talk to their teenage daughter about like drugs or something. They were having a practice scenario before they went to go talk to their teenage daughter. And it seems so hokey, you know, but it's true. Offices will do that. You watch training, a lot of training videos. Anybody who's ever got a new job, you have to watch all the onboarding videos about what not to do. But it's true. If you play out a scenario, then when something happens, it's like, okay, I'm ready.
But I will say, just to your point, watching a video is great for knowledge, but it's not experience or wisdom based or practiced. I can watch a video about a lot of things. But unless you play it out, and that's the best training I've done, demonstration performance training, where I've seen something demonstrated, then I perform it back for evaluation.
Correct.
And I get better at it with every new and iterative demonstration and performance. For me, there's something else I was reading and I can't remember, so I'm going to badly quote it. But this person was talking about creativity and the most creative and best leaders, team managers leave space on their calendar.
Margin.
They keep there that they don't let anyone get messed with because they need time to have space for doing things with, for pop-up meetings, for interactions, for just time just to think and read.
So the sister to calm is stillness. Stillness does not mean nothingness because stillness isn't actually empty. She's talking about it on page 108 in the book. She describes it as clearing an emotional space. So is stress, anxiety, busyness, all of that defining your life? Everybody talks about New Year's and detoxing. How about detox from anxiety? What? That's sort of a hot phrase. Everybody's saying, I'll hold space for you. I'm going to hold space for your emotions. I'm going to hold space for your opinions. And you know, what does that mean? You know, you're like, what space?
What? And that's where I think stillness is. Like I came in and I needed to do like four or five things. And it was like too much because I had to do too many things all at once this afternoon. So I had to create stillness for a minute and be like, okay, give myself time to breathe. First it was calm. Then it was manage my emotional reaction. And then it was walk away and just provide a stillness because I didn't have to do all five things that minute.
When you were thinking that you had to do everything all at once and it was just overloaded, what happened?
A small panic attack, small breathing episode where I literally was not able to manage what was going on.
And it kind of overlaps, right? Like, right. So you have all of these tasks and then all of a sudden your anxiety spikes and they like blur together.
Yeah, it was crazy. And like, so what is going on?
So you had to create a stillness, which isn't nothing. Like you had to just step away for a minute to make space to like reorganize.
Right.
What's first, second, third.
And I was doing that at the same time that I was calm, being aware, and then realizing I wasn't using the right tool to manage my emotional reaction. Mm. And that's why I was just like, okay, so get some stillness in there, figure out some calm, manage my emotional reaction. And I was able to think better after that.
I'm naturally a list maker. And this makes sense of like, why? Like, oh, that's my way of creating stillness. I have to literally like sit down and write out things. And that way it's not all jumbled around. And it's not going to turn into a snowball and like run me off the road. So I make a list. She writes in the book that the stillness isn't just holding still. What it means is that you're, quote, opening up an emotionally clutter-free space and allowing ourselves to feel and think and dream and question. So it's not only related to anxiety and stress, if you note, it's actually an emotionally clutter-free space. That's the stillness. A lot of people have a hard time meditating. You sit and like, you think, oh, you know, you just think of these, what did you call them?
Navel gazing.
Navel gazing meditation.
That's, old 90s term.
That's a hard because your mind just wanders to all the things you need to get done and like all your time management, blah, blah, blah. She talks about how she likes to go for a walk and that actually helps create a stillness in her mind because now she has a space. She's not thinking about walking. So right. Now she can open up her mind and just think about all of these other things. I was thinking about that and I thought, huh, like a warm bath can do the same thing. Like that's more of a holding still, but it's almost like your nervous system can take a break.
Right.
She says that if you stop long enough and you create quiet emotional clearing, the truth of our lives will invariably catch up with us.
Sorry, I have like Aladdin genie going like, tell her the truth. Anyways, I'm like, what is the truth? Like Aladdin, genie when he's telling Aladdin.
Oh, tell her the truth.
And it's like, what is the truth? It's like, do I really want to know the truth of our lives?
Right. And so I think that's why people can get caught up in their manic lives. We stay so busy because we don't want to sit still and think about ourselves.
Well, then, because I think a lot of people's truth is actually a lie. We all battle with lies that are in our lives of like how much we're a failure, there's screw ups or stuff like that. I think that feeds the anxiety. So we're worried that if we sit still too long,
reality catches up.
And the reality that we think is out there isn't true. It's what's feeding the anxiety. When if we actually take the time to listen to ourselves, the actual truth shows up, not what we're afraid of, not what we're lying to ourselves about, but who we actually are as parents, sons, daughters, whatever, and what's important in our lives will come to fruition, will come into reality, and we'll be able to see it. But you got to get past all that anxiety.
She talks about that. She says that we try to stay in front of the truth about how tired, scared, confused, overwhelmed, but sometimes feel. And that the irony is that the thing that's wearing us down is trying to stay out in front of feeling worn down. The self-perpetuating quality of anxiety. That's literally what it is. It feeds on itself. This is all on page 108, you guys. It almost feels so obvious.
It always sounds obvious when somebody else learned it and then wrote it down for us to read. And we're just like, well, duh, because we identify truth naturally. It rings true based off our experience. We're like, yep, that is true. I can verify that myself. There are things that I learn about in books and I have to take it on faith because I don't have the experience or wisdom to understand or know that it's true. So I have to put a little bit of belief and faith into, so it must be true. Because they have bona fides. But there's times because all of us, in my experience, deal with anxiety or are in the human condition. And this is truth. Thank you for putting into words what I knew intuitively or emotionally or understood through my own life.
I wonder sometimes, especially in our culture, American culture, if we aren't actually addicted to stress and anxiety. It's almost like a badge of honor, like a calling card, like, oh, I'm a hot mess and you're a hot mess. Look at all the things I'm doing. I'm so stressed out. But it also means, look at all the things I'm doing. Aren't I amazing?
Oh, yeah.
So the detox from stress and anxiety can be very difficult if that's your status quo.
I look at somebody who's calm or still or has that mentality. I'm like, I'm envious or jealous of what they've put down to achieve that.
Right.
But I'm not willing to do that because my badge of honor is my busyness, is my work hard and get it done. Because who am I? What is the truth about me if I don't have that?
Right.
Who am I without that? And I'm have before not been willing to find out.
Mm. Right. And so we fall into our patterns of managing our own anxieties. It's like overfunctioning.
Yeah. I'm more comfortable there.
More comfortable overfunctioning. I think I am too. It's like feeding off of stress. Like, okay, what's next? And the old adage of like, if you give a busy person something to do, it'll get done. Because they're juggling so much anyway, they'll just add it to their plate. Versus the other side of that coin is like, give a lazy person something to do and it won't get done. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're a lazy person. It's just somebody who goes, priorities on my list. Like, meh, okay. What is it you're giving them to do, right?
There's adages out there. There's different people who are like, if it's a priority, do it. If it's not a priority, delegate it. There are things that can't be delegated. And who are you delegating that to? Because if it's not a priority for you, but it still needs done, can it be delegated? Well, yeah, it could. Do you have somebody to delegate it to? Well, no. Okay, then hire somebody or do it yourself because it's still a priority. I get frustrated when people are just like, oh, that's not my job. Somebody else should do that.
Right.
Somebody doesn't always show up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably why I function in this high state of anxiety and I'm a workaholic and or recovering workaholic and recovering perfectionist.
So to detox would be to delegate something. Less caffeine. Is that a truth?
Yes, I've gone down in my caffeine consumption.
Congratulations.
I don't drink. There was a time I was drinking over a pot a day.
Pot of coffee a day. Yeah.
And
it's like making up for all the years we didn't drink it in our 20s.
Yes. Because you didn't have to drink coffee in your 20s. You were just naturally more awake.
Yeah. And another tangible detox tactic is to say out loud, I am safe. Tell yourself that so you can hear it.
That's the hardest one.
Because you argue with yourself.
Yeah, I'm not always right. Seriously, I sometimes I'm just like, you're safe. I'm like, no, you're not. Yes, I am. And this conversation can go on for a while.
Of course, there's daily movement. It doesn't have to be strenuous in any kind, but it just helps kind of get that energy out of you. Recognize your personal triggers and practice the role playing if you can. Practice role playing those triggers so that you have a muscle memory in place that you've built in of a calm reaction versus your reactive reaction. And you super, super, super have to practice this if these weren't modeled for you in your own childhood. I like how she describes the two types of anxiety patterns. So you have overfunctioners who tend to be really quick to give advice, take over, micromanage. They get into other people's business rather than looking inward. Like you said, like avoiding truth, avoiding themselves, like afraid of what you're going to see. But then on the other side, you have underfunctioners and they get less competent when they're stressed out. They actually invite other people to take over. She talks about how they are often the focus of family gossip. I'm wondering if that's like a black sheep. Oh, you know, you have Uncle so-and-so or...
It's always an uncle. It's never an aunt. It's always an uncle. Talk about it, about the ants, and it's just like...
The anthill comes out in storm.
Yeah. No, the ants are in force.
You don't talk about the ants. They have high heels.
Yeah.
And they know how to use them. But there's often an underfunctioner might become the focus of the family worry, concern, etc. They get labeled as irresponsible or like the problem child, the fragile one. These are all quotes from page 109. But recognizing that these can be just patterns of behavior stemming from like a deeper rooted anxiety without any practice of a calmer stillness helps us to understand that we can actually change that.
I think that's also just recognizing you can change. Getting the calmness to identify what's going on. and then figuring out the tools to like practice.
Right.
Like, but it does, it takes practice. I went to a gym once and I found a bunch of people crawling across the floor. I was like,
that's crazy.
What is going on? It was a physical therapy class. They were literally practicing how to crawl correctly. There's these folks that were, they went straight down to the fundamentals. You're not running correctly because you didn't crawl correctly. That's, it was just like, we're going to walk you through and rebuild that muscle memory properly.
Hmm.
And I was like,
Nope.
I'm good.
I'm out. I would have just walked right out.
But that's the thing. It's like everybody's at a different
level.
Crawl, walk, run level.
Right.
You don't, some of us don't have to go back to crawling to figure out how to walk correctly.
Thank you, Jesus.
I'm good. But at the same time, I was running one day with a friend and they looked at me and like, why are you doing heel toe? That's terrible for your back. And I was like, well, I can't run on the pad of my foot. I was out of practice. I wasn't conditioned. Now I do all 4 foot running. It's, I don't do heel toe strike when I run anymore. It took me a year to build up the conditioning to do that, but I didn't have to go back to crawling. I just figured out how to run differently. And it involved a lot more walking when I was out for a run. I'd go for a shorter jog, walk, and then step back up again.
And sorry, what did you call that?
4 foot. Pad foot. I don't know. It's just, I run on the forward part of my foot.
Okay, because you said the 4 foot, and I was like, you have 2 feet.
Yes. I don't know. Is there something out of there we can get out of?
No, it's just you and your fabulous new running style. It's all okay. About how she cultivates things. And yes. So, yes, you have to crawl when you must. Walk if you can. Run. Oh, gosh, there's that quote somewhere. Walk if you have to. Crawl if you must. Just never give up. Something like that.
I like that. That's a good quote.
Heck yeah.
Rebecca Castleman said that.
I didn't. It's
you did just now.
Dad joke for the win. It's like unknown author. So according to Matthew McConaughey, you can just steal whatever and put your name on it and win awards. So he won a poetry contest when he was a kid. That wraps up Guidepost 8. Moving on to number 9, cultivating meaningful work, letting go of self-doubt, and supposed to. Here's a question. What is it that you do that gives you a sense of accomplishment? Is it your job, career, your calling? If you don't do the things that light you up, it will become a heavy source of pain that you will carry around and most likely bleed on everybody else around you. Shabam.
The gem here is that meaningful work is not always what you're paid to do.
Ding, ding, ding. Do I have... You guys, I have a new podcast system that was my Christmas present. Thank you, James. With sound effects. I don't know if I have a ding, ding. I'll have to find it because I think that is definitely a nail on the head. The buttons are not labeled. They're just colorful. There's like purple, pink, blue, teal... There's 8 of them. Nope.
Ooh, if you push them, it turns them off.
The gem. Okay, I love that one. Nope. Okay. No. That's the gem. Okay, the gem here.
The gem here. Is... meaningful work is not always work that you're paid to do. It's not what pays the bills. That's really hard for me because I think that what I do that makes money is all meaningful. But here it's like, it's not always what you're gifted, what your natural talents are, what you've been called to do. Simon Sinek talks about it in a book called Infinite Game. He calls it your just cause. And I was just like, oh. So it's figuring out like, as Brené Brown talks about it, your meaningful work, how do you embrace that? What do you do with that? Well, for us, one of those things that we're working on is a podcast. It's meaningful to us.
In her research, she makes it clear that part of living a wholehearted life includes some sort of a calling, so that it's something that gives you a sense of accomplishment. And like you said, it doesn't necessarily have to be monetary, which I think we often forget. We attach a monetary value to everything. And if it doesn't have a gain, we consider it loss. I underlined the sense of accomplishment part, and I wrote down that parenting is very meaningful, but it often lacks that sense of accomplishment. There's a purpose there, but because it's such a long game, it doesn't feel like there's any kind of reward. So you have to supplement other work, other accomplishments to kind of buoy yourself when you start feeling burnout. And that's my perspective from being a stay-at-home mom for several years. It's like one of the best things that I've ever done, but also one of the hardest things I've ever done. There were times that I was there for my kids that couldn't have been otherwise. It is extremely meaningful. And God called me to be the mother of those kids.
Right.
So it is a calling, but it might not be my natural talents or gifts.
Right.
Because I have other callings.
There's a quote in here that I really like that she talks about. Culture doesn't get to dictate what's meaningful to you. Like your gifts and talents, meaning is unique to each one of us. So while parenting is meaningful, or a job in a particular industry is meaningful, it might not mean the same to you. It's a gift, it's a talent, but it's not...
Is it fulfilling?
It's not fulfilling that thing that you need to have as a wholehearted person to cultivate meaningful work.
Right. And she talks about the effects of not partaking in a meaningful work. She says that, this is on page 112. She says, we all have these gifts and talents, all of us, and they're all different, right? We cultivate them and we share them with the world. Then we are going to create this sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. But if we squander our gifts, don't use them, ignore them, put them to the side because our parents said that they weren't, you know, being doctors and lawyers. No offense, doctors and lawyers. But it brings distress to your lives. And it's not just, oh, well, that's too bad. You're not using your gift. She says that we actually pay for it with emotional and physical well-being. You will struggle. You're going to feel disconnected, weighed down by feelings of emptiness, frustration, resentment, shame, disappointment, fear, and even grief. That's a lot to carry around. Now, some people, you say, well, what are your gifts and talents? What's your meaningful work? Like, what's your calling? They don't have a clue.
Or I'm embarrassed about what I'm good at, or I don't want to share it because I doubt that it's actually a real talent.
Because it's so personal. Because it's part of your being. Entertain the thought, however, that if that thing that's part of who you are is from a divine creator and you don't use that, you don't share that.
I think you're missing out.
What are the ramifications?
Right. I have told myself that I am not talented, or I don't have what anybody else would consider a talent. Like, I'm not a musician. I'm not an artistic individual. So a story that I've created was that I'm not creative, and it perpetuated. Well, I'm actually incredibly creative, but it's not in ways that it's usually demonstrated.
Right. So it's almost like being creative and realizing what your talents and gifts are. Because most of us, she talks about, we look up at the sky and we're like, oh, why does God live so far away? But he's actually literally inside of us, sharing the gifts and talents with the world as the most powerful, powerful source of connection with God. It's so cool when you stop and go, oh, you know, it's like, okay, imagine you give a gift to somebody, some wonderful gift, it's like Christmas or whatever. And they're like, cool, I'm gonna go over here and play with the box instead. You know, we're always so upset. But then imagine this wonderful gift and you just wish, man, I really want them to open it. If they would just see what's inside, if they wouldn't be afraid to unwrap it, like how much wonder and amazement could there be?
You're talking about the sky, and I was just remembering, I told this to one of my kids. We were looking outside and it's not dark out, and they were wishing they could see more of the stars. And I said, yeah, the sky is full of light we cannot see. One, open your eyes. Two, get away from things that are artificial light that's blinding you so that you can actually see real light. And sometimes, yeah, we need better tools to be able to really capture what's out there that we don't have the ability to see right away with our own eyes.
Right. Well, and it's on page 112 and 113. Some of the things that get in the way of seeing that light, she calls them gremlins, you know, but it's literally like you're thinking, well, everybody has these gifts and things except for me. I don't have any, but that's false. Or maybe it's something that you do. It could literally be clerical work. And somebody's like, well, that's not a gift. That's not big enough. It's not important enough. It's not talent. Enter in your self-doubt, right? Self-doubt will undermine your gifts and the words supposed to. You start doing what you are supposed to be doing, what you should be doing. Here's a challenge. Try to remove the word should from your vocabulary for a week, for a month, 30 days.
Get rid of the shoulda, woulda, couldas.
Yes. And the supposed to. Well, I should, dot, dot, dot. I'm supposed to, dot, dot, dot. Ellipses.
I like that. It's also like owning. I am. Oh, I will.
Right.
I can.
Because the supposed to's and should's literally mummify your talents and gifts. We can't sit down to do our podcast because we should be
sleeping.
Sleeping, making a healthy, balanced meal.
Raising our children.
Writing books. Working. Editing books. Earning money.
Earning money. That's good. Paying the bills is important. Please remember, pay your bills.
Yes. And if you want to help support this podcast, you can always go to Buy Me a Coffee. We will put a link in the description. It'll help pay the bill for this little podcast, if you would so choose. You can also like us, leave a review, etc. That also helps podcasts as well. So if your talents and gifts are connected to your spirit, when was the last time that you actually honored your spirit? When was the last time you honored that? Honored yourself. It's a big deal to honor other people. We are very strict when it comes to being rude and respectful. Like our kids will even say, they're 3 years old, they'll be like, that's so rude. Why? Because we've said that is rude. You need to treat people with respect, right? Do you treat yourself with respect? I think sometimes we forget to. We're our own worst critics, our worst enemies. We say things to ourselves we would never say to somebody else. So we talked about being on your love list, being on the top of your love list. I think this plays into it significantly, because if you're ignoring your God-given talents and gifts, you will struggle, whether that's discernment, listening. You have a good listening ear. You can just let people vent to you. There's literal surveys like we've taken that you answer these questions. And it's like, here's all these gifts that you have that you don't even realize. She says that you have to own the message of what makes you afraid, what's actually on your supposed to list. And who says? Is that coming from your parents? Is it coming from society? Because you want to fit in and be cool? It sounds so high school, but yeah, adults super want to fit in and be cool.
Very much so.
I wrote down in my book underneath a blurb where she's talking about write it down. Write down what the gremlins are saying so it takes away that power. It's like, look, yeah, I'm afraid of this, but I'm going to do it anyway. That's what I wrote in my book. I'm afraid. Do it afraid. Period. Her next little section is like, nice to meet you. What do you do? Ugh. Attached up in the stupid gremlins is like the what do you do phrase. It's like, do you have enough time for me to tell you all the things that I literally do? Like, no, they just want to hear, I'm a teacher.
Right.
And then they make a bunch of assumptions about who you are as a person.
I'm in the Air Force. Most people think I'm a pilot.
Right.
That's the first thing is like, they're like,
how many jobs are in the Air Force? I mean...
Lots of jobs. 22 years now, I've done 5 of them.
We call it like wearing multiple hats, or right now it's like the slash effect. So people put on their bios on social platforms like their top 3 or even top 5 professions or things that they do, right? So you can be like, I have on mine, I'm an actor, director, and writer. Like I have 3 different things that I do, and they're all in a creative realm. But you have some people that are like, oh, I'm a lawyer, I'm a public speaker, I'm a physical trainer. So you have this like slash, I call it a slash effect. Sounds bad, like a slasher movie or something. Because we're all multi-layered. Nobody's one thing.
And it's become a bigger thing in the last 10, 15 years. They've talked about it and written books on it, but it's ever since Zoolander with the Slashy Award. Nice little pop culture reference. But felt like back in the day, people were one thing. But now we're actually being able to say, no, you are multifaceted. Mm-hmm. You can be a husband, son, father, brother, all at the same time. And that's still just a aspect of you. Then it's like all the different things that you bring to the table. Mm-hmm. And nobody needs to have a resume ready to explain all the different things.
Right.
But it is that you are at the minute. But it is like do you want a 12-second explanation, or are we going to have a full-blown conversation about this?
Right. And we don't usually tell people whatever our hobby is.
Right.
I'm not a gardener. I don't have a garden. I don't feed the community. I just have a couple pretty flowers that I've collected and put in my backyard over the years. You know, it's like, well, if somebody else who doesn't know how to grow a potato from a freaking, you know, pansy comes into your backyard and they go, oh my gosh, this is gorgeous. Like, you're a gardener. It's like, oh yeah, it's part of the garden club once. And like, it's a hobby. Oh, maybe this is a talent you have. Not to say that, you know, you have to give it away to everybody, but being able to claim that and not be ashamed of it. Go, oh, you know what? Yeah. It's like, I dabble. We say, oh, we minimize it. I dabble in gardening.
Not minimizing who you are and the different aspects of who you are.
Mm-hmm. Brene's like, claim it, claim your work. She talks about how she was at some seminar thing and she met this woman. And she's like, oh my gosh, she was like wearing some jewelry that this woman had made. And she's like, oh yeah, you make jewelry. And she's like, no.
I'm not a jeweler.
Yeah, I'm not a jeweler. And then it's like, what? Some people are very crafty. And it's like, well, they have an Etsy shop or whatever. And they sell their art, right? And they actually can make an income. And others don't. They just make it and they can give it away as a gift, or it's more of a hobby. That doesn't mean you're less of a jeweler.
It's just whether or not it's what pays the bills, or do you have a storefront, or is it something you do in your basement?
Because I don't do it enough, because it's not my full time. Well, most of the things that light us up, that we're very talented in, or that are our gifts, don't pay the bills. We don't do them full time. If we did them full time, we would starve. There's a fabulous quote in here, and I'll get to it in a second. It's talking about what the world needs. Ask the question, instead of what do you do, you ask what kind of problems do you want to solve in the world? Okay. But then that makes you think, well, what does the world need? Enter in the should. Well, I should XYZ. But instead, it's like trying to deliberately figure out what your meaningful is. And she has this beautiful quote in here from Howard Thurman. It says, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. Go do that. Go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive.
I love that quote. And it speaks to me, but it's also the struggle of also being able to pay the bills. Can what makes me come alive keep me alive? and it's being able to draw the connection, because sometimes what culture doesn't think is meaningful and what makes you come alive isn't what also pays the bills. I think because I had identified my work as my meaningful work for so long, but it really wasn't what made me come alive. There were aspects of my work that made me come alive, that
true,
I
could,
that were meaningful work within it.
Well, what makes you come alive?
Actually teaching and inspiring others.
Right.
So anytime I was teaching or inspiring others and seeing them flourish from that was meaningful to me. Some of the stuff that I do in my job, not meaningful at all. Still needs to be
you.
Done.
It's right. Still,
like, it's so hard. Words.
Somebody
so
has
hard.
To take the trash out.
So, this has to be done. Just because it matters doesn't mean it's meaningful.
Mm.
And I think that's where I'm figuring it out. This matters, but it's not meaningful work to me. Mm-hmm. It's not feeding my spirit. Still matters. Still must be done. Finding meaningful work and also continuing to take care of us, our family. It's been interesting trying to figure that out, but realizing that I was identifying what matters as meaningful and they're not synonymous.
Correct. And it's important to figure out what makes meaningful work meaningful to you. She writes her meaningful work needs to be inspiring, contemplative, and creative. She narrowed it down to like three things. And it really helps filter out like how she spends her time, what she commits to. And I wrote right next to that in the book. And I was like, ooh, yes, because I said, time is fleeting. It's finite and therefore valuable.
Another book she references, Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, which if you haven't read it, definitely recommend. But he talks about three criteria for meaningful work as complexity, autonomy, and relationship between effort and reward. And that's where I think for all of us is figuring out which one of these rings true for us inside our own understanding of what is meaningful to us for our work, to really flesh out that wholehearted life. And that's been an interesting path of separating what matters, what is meaningful, figuring out what is my meaningful work to cultivate that.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the steps she talks about, get going in the back of here. How do you dig deep? It's like, make a list of work that inspires you. Maybe it's something you haven't even done before, but it's something that kind of inspires you, right? And she's like, don't be practical. You do this in your, like your 10-10-1, you know, your big dreams, 10 years, just imagine you as like the most amazing you that you could ever be. You don't have to be practical. Get rid of the should. Okay. No more shoulds and supposed to. It's literally like dream big. Let's clear some space. Let's get some stillness going so we can dream.
My 2030 version of myself is not practical.
Do you have a Superman cape?
Pretty darn close.
That's awesome. Don't think about how you're going to make the money, make the living, et cetera, et cetera. All you have to do is think about doing something that you love. And if you don't know, you need to kind of sit with this and really contemplate, explore.
I think that's an awesome opportunity. If you're sitting here and this gives you anxiety, because a year and a half ago, the pressure of not knowing, actually it was 2.5 years ago when I first sat down and did my 10-10-1. 10 years from now, 10 dreams that you want to have realized in your life in 10 years from now. And then one goal that you can work on every year to build towards that. It's 10 dreams of yourself at the 10-year mark.
Right.
So it's one goal each year that you work on towards that vision of yourself. Anyway, there was a lot of pressure of like, who do I want to be? What is that? What does my wholehearted living look like?
And we ask this of little children, like in kindergarten, first grade, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they're like, it's easy to say like a firefighter or a policeman or something like that. You know, that really speaks to their heart. They want to help people.
Right. So I realized my 10-year version of myself has no job title. There's no job title in any of those 10 dreams.
Wow.
Now, I would like to be making a certain amount of money that's self-sustaining so that we can keep going forward. That's identified. How that comes into play, I left it open-ended.
Right. I mean, we like to say, it's something else. It's some hobby on the side. Well, maybe your job is super meaningful to you. And that's your meaningful work.
Like, which is awesome.
That's super awesome. Some people have figured out a way to actually make money at things that like delight them.
Yes.
Great.
I really hope bakers, chefs, and pastors, doctors, and nurses are all experiencing their meaningful work.
And pilots.
And pilots, firefighters, and police right after that. I would have to say, knowing several of those individuals, they're all just doing the job and they're doing it really well. But they also have found ways to address who they are as a person outside of whatever that uniform is.
Mm. It's like, that's the slash effect. That's the multi-hat. That's the
slash effect, because a really good firefighter usually is a good grill master. I don't know how those go hand in hand. But
right? It's like, wait.
But it's like,
are there stereotypes like that fit?
if they're this, then they're also this, this, and this. And this is what makes up Jeff. Or right. Jerry, who they are as a person is way more than just the job.
What about Sarah and Sally?
You can have Sarah and Sally in your story. Jerry, Sarah, and Sally grilling at a firehouse.
Doesn't mean you have to replace what you're doing right now and like totally get rid of like your status quo in your life right now. Like that's...
I definitely did not quit my job 2 years ago just because my vision of myself in 10 years was not working.
I'm out. I'm done. But it's basically adding that slash. And I love, the stereotypical, you picture people that are elderly and they're taking all these random classes at the Y or whatever it is. Like, oh, I took a photography class and now I signed up to do, painting. they're just doing all these things they never got to do when they were providing for right. their family, for when you were trying to have a house, a home, live, survive. But you get to a point where you're not taking care of everybody else in the universe. You can actually look inward and get a little bit reflective. But you take different classes and you try different things and you realize, I like this. Maybe you like ceramics and you've never in your life gotten to play with clay before. You just randomly booked some studio time and got a little lesson and you're like, fall in love with it. You don't know until you try. It's okay if it doesn't stick the first time. The goal is to just find something that brings meaning to you. It doesn't even have to be useful.
Which gets us into the 10th guidepost.
Wait.
Okay.
I wrote in the book after that.
You wrote in the book after that? What did you write?
I wrote down some things that were meaningful to me.
Ooh.
I did. I started making my list. And it's not big yet. I don't want to minimize it. Be like, it's not enough. It's just what I was thinking of when I read this. So I have two, but then I have sub bullets because I'm super organized. The first one, storytelling, with sub bullets under there, acting, characters. I love a good character. And then I put directing, because even when I'm acting, it's hard for me to take off the directing hat and think of all the externals. But you have to when you're trying to do a role, because you need to be very inward. You have to believe the character. Huh. And the other one was encouraging. And my sub bullets for that are lifting people up, reminding people that God delights in them, all of them, warts and all. Hopefully this podcast is encouraging. But those are my two right now. It's like, okay, what brings meaning to me? What fills my heart with a sense of accomplishment, meaningful work? Ooh, storytelling and encouraging. What if I could put those together and have an encouraging story? Bum, bum, bum. That's what a rom-com is. And I wrote one and I made one and it's in post-production and it's almost done, which is taking forever and a day.
Which most stories take forever and a day to publish, produce, create.
Finance.
Only Earth was made in 6 days.
Right. I know. A couple people have reached out. Hey, where's that movie? Listen, everybody wants to get paid and every part of the post-production costs money. So yes, takes longer than you think.
Yep.
This is my list that has meaning to me, but it's not like an unpractical list. I haven't gone so crazy as to like figure out what's my criteria.
Visiting Paris.
What?
Unrealistic criteria for storytelling.
Oh, What's his face saying?
What's his face said?
What's his face was talking about how criteria for meaningful work, complexity. So autonomy is one.
Yes.
Especially like as a mother and even as an actor or director, it's all collaborative. Like, where's your autonomy? What part do you get to own that's yours?
I would say parenting is pretty autonomous. You own it.
What the face? No, it is not.
You are definitely telling people what to do. There's no one above you.
Okay. What's the definition of autonomy? You're just going to pull that out of somewhere, aren't you? Like, instead of looking it up. I know you have a phone.
Yeah. Okay.
You're like, well, yep. Autonomy, according to the dictionary that I read when I was 17.
Once before I read something about autonomy. The right or condition of self-government, freedom from external control or influence, independence. Parenting and directing, directing, actually, you're beholden to a producer, but parenting, yeah, that's what I was, semantics. I would say you have a lot of autonomy as a parent that you don't.
And I'm like, no, you don't, because I feel like as a mom, you aren't your own being anymore. You have little extensions of you, even though I think of us as separate. Babies don't think of themselves as separate until right. they're like two, and then enter in separation anxiety because you're their safe space.
So that's what, so you're thinking self-governing, like you
not necessarily
are independent from yes, other people.
Yes. Not like isolated, but like I made this thing and I did it myself. So even if say I get out my painting supplies and I'm painting a picture and I'm like, got my acrylics out. It's like, great. Okay. Well, I have a kid behind me. They're also painting a picture. That's fine. They're doing their own thing and I'm doing my own thing. I have my own canvas. So I have autonomy. But now what if I'm painting my picture, but I'm following along a step-by-step Bob Ross guide? This is okay, you guys. I actually have
like a Bob Ross guide picture.
Oh, yeah, I have pretty a couple awesome. Books. And did you know Bob Ross used to live in North Pole, Alaska, where we're from?
Yes, he did. Because he's awesome. And he was in the Air Force. Just saying.
What? Okay. Random facts. I'm not good at a trivia game, but I feel like you'd be really good at trivia.
I can't handle the pressure.
James, what's the answer?
I don't know. Ask me when you don't need it.
But like, is that my own painting now? Because I'm following along these instructions and I'm trying to mirror something else. I don't feel like it's autonomous.
I just want to say before this gets lost, my meaningful work is providing trivia when it's meaningless.
I think you also have... We have like a whole journal of James one-liners.
Yes.
We, our family, even has multiple copies of Uncle James sayings. So you have a famous quote and then you flip it over on a Jenga block. And on the backside, it's like pithy sayings from Uncle James. Uncle James says, and he totally just counterpoints everything. Some famous person said something really philosophical and you flip it over and he's like snarky, snarky. Maybe one of your meaningful gifts is one-liners. Snarky one-liners?
No, I'm really loving my meaningful work.
Just a bunch of one-liners. Providing
trivia when it's meaningless.
Oh my gosh. I think you're right because we were at the antique store and it's for my birthday month, you guys. And so we were looking for nightstands for the children.
Right. Because she has autonomy.
I ended up finding something for myself, yes. Which was great. I found a lovely bracelet. Anyway, we go to check out. And while I'm like, where's James? We're texting each other. We're like lost in this antique mall. You know, you turn one corner and it's like you just get lost finding treasures. So he comes up to the counter and he, of course, found two books. So that's what he found.
Yes.
I love it. You always find books. They're treasure.
They are.
So we're checking out. I'm checking out with one lady. He's checking out with another lady instead of checking out together. Because I was like.
You were already checking out.
I was like, let's go. So then he starts checking out and you open a book and you're like, babe, look what I found around the world in 80 days. And then you like flipped it open and you're like, did you know? Just start spouting trivia facts.
It was interesting.
It was very interesting. There's like three old ladies and me and you're like, knowledge.
And then I was like, all right, I'm out.
What was it?
And the little explanation of around the world in 80 days, Phileas Fogg's man, his servant man, was named Passepartout. And Passepartout, and it was explaining this, means go everywhere. And it's from the same derivative of passport, which means master key. And in it, here Phileas Fogg is going around the world in 80 days with his servant man, Passepartout. And Passepartout helps him get into all of the different countries and everywhere it goes. And I was just like laughing because this was back before all of the countries had passports. So here is Jules Verne actually using the explanation that to get around the world, you need your passport.
Which was so cool. But it was just this trivia that you were like, I will share this with you guys. It didn't matter the moment. It didn't matter. We were trying to check out in the checkout line. So I had to have you repeat it later because I was distracted with my checkout.
Well, what happened when I left?
Okay. So then we had to get these nightstands out to the truck. So he's hauling nightstands out. And I was like, what a weird guy. And the lady goes, do you know him? And I was like, oh yeah, he's my husband. She's like, oh, is he a teacher? I was like, you know what? Yes. He doesn't teach for his profession, but he definitely has a teacher's heart. And so I just shared that with these ladies. They thought you were endearing and fine. And because I'm your wife, I'm just like, oh, here we go again.
He's going to say something else.
Yeah. He's going to come back in here for the next one. Anyway. Yeah. So then we were hauling these things out. And then, oh my gosh, you guys, my wallet dropped. We were hauling out these nightstands and I had my hands full. We like drove away, went back because of course we had separate cars for some reason. We had to go drive and get my car that was left in some parking lot. Because we're so organized.
Very organized.
We're so organized.
So organized.
And I'm like, oh, I can't drive my car home. I don't have my driver's license. Where's my wallet? So we're looking all through the truck. So we had to like go back to the freaking antique mall to see the old ladies. And it was just so funny to me. It's like, I forgot my passport.
Can't go anywhere without your passport.
That's right. I needed it. And they were very kind. They had found it. It had fallen on the floor right there inside. Thankfully, it wasn't outside. You know, somebody took off with it. They were like, oh, I'm glad you came back. We weren't about to call the police.
Which, did you guys know that the police is a great location for lost and found things like IDs?
Right. It's a public service. Right. That does track. That makes sense. But I think I was always raised to not bother emergency workers, personnel.
Emergency service personnel.
Yeah. Like, you don't call 911 ever unless, like, you have a detached limb.
Right.
Because there's people that need to get through that phone line. That's not a prank. That's no. You hear the stories about kids like, oh, I need help with my homework. So I call 911 because I'm supposed to call them if I need help. Okay. Put into context for your children, because now somebody's having a heart attack and they can't get through because your child's on the phone. Whatever, kids. But homework, I mean,
matters, but it's not meaningful to this emergency services.
Right. And so I never crossed my mind to call the police to say, oh, I lost my ID. You know, do you have it? Just, it seems trite, but that's your ID. Okay. Cards, credit cards, you can cancel. You can call in and cancel them. But like our driver's license, our out of state driver's license, because we're military. And so to get a new one, like you can't just go to the DMV here.
No.
Where we live.
It's a little
harder. Yeah. Where we live is not where we're residents of. It's so weird. Anyway, we're freaking out a little bit, but everything is well. I'm sorry, there's probably an ending to this book. That's a terrible ending.
That's a terrible ending. No, this is a great actual, so cultivating play is the last guidepost.
Is it?
Yes.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. Play, sing, and dance. We have a whole nother guidepost to talk about. Cultivating laughter, song, and dance.
Letting go of being cool and always in control.
That's hard. Really hard. I mean, I'm not cool. I've never had to worry about that one. But control, yes.
But were you always that way?
No.
Me neither. No. I'm very goofy. I think I'm still goofy, but now I have learned to only be that way with people that I know. Like, it's reserved for home or close friends.
I think I actually have just decided that I am cool and I need to let go of that.
Yeah, we know.
Okay.
At some point you were like, I'm cool now.
Yeah.
I speak into your life and I tell you, like, you're amazing. You're smart. You're worthy. All these things, right? And I think at some point you're like, I am. You started to believe it for yourself, which is good. That's not a bad thing. It's just obviously when ego gets to somebody's head.
I told you you're beautiful and you're like, no, I'm not. Shut up. You're wrong.
I don't receive that today. Okay. In my defense, I had come down the stairs like a literal troll, like hunched over. My heel was hurting, like one of those plantar fasciitis things. I was like hobbling down the stairs and my hair was insane.
And I said, good morning, beautiful.
I was like, what the face? I was like affronted that you would say such a lie.
Apparently my standards just were called into question.
Yes, clearly. You weren't even close enough. Like, if you could smell this breath. I was trying to hurry down the stairs to say goodbye to our kids who are running off to school.
So this opens up with a quote that I had to write down this, and I love it because it's a quote from Mark Twain, and I like his writing sometimes. Some of his stuff is too much, but I hadn't seen all of this quote.
I'm sorry, before. Did you just diss Mark Twain?
Oh, yeah.
How very dare you?
Have you tried to read all of his works?
He's a prolific writer.
Prolific, yes. Does that mean great?
The time in which he was writing.
It was very appropriate.
Correct.
Yeah, I just could never get into Yankee and King Arthur's court. Anyway, but he had this quote, and I've heard the first half of it, but I have no recollection of this ever being said fully, except for here when Brené brought it up. And it's, dance like no one is watching, sing like no one is listening. And I've heard this a lot, but then, I mean, it's Mark Twain. He doesn't stop there. Love like you've never been hurt and live like it's heaven on earth. And I just love that because it's just, he's acknowledging that it's not heaven. And
it's painful.
And it's painful. He doesn't give you the opportunity to, he's like, no, do it anyways.
Right. Like Mother Teresa, do it anyway.
Just do it anyways. Mm. Laugh, sing, and dance. Love. And live. And I just love that about Mark.
Think about someone who makes you laugh or your favorite song. How valuable is that in your life? When you hear music and you just want to dance, or there's a joyous occasion when your team wins, those are all those moments when it's okay to dance like no one is watching, right? You have this freedom to do that. So why is it we bind ourselves from having that freedom on the regular?
There was a moment I was doing a ropes course, and I experienced the most fear I've probably ever really experienced in my life. And it was a controlled environment. It was really, it was testing everything about my physical and my sense of fear. And I found my limits in that course. And I get done and get out of it, and we're hanging out as a team, and we're recounting a couple of things. And I just start laughing with a teammate who also, they had hit their limit as well and had to step out. But we're laughing and releasing the fear and the stress and letting go because we couldn't control. And that was one of the most healing laughters I've ever experienced. We weren't trying to be cool at that moment. We were acknowledging, yep, everybody saw the sheer panic and mm-hmm. and fear. And
there's no hiding from it.
There's no hiding
from it. It was real.
There was real. There was no being cool. There was no control. Yet. So we laughed.
Right. Because that's the medicine. Why is laughter so important? Why is singing, songs, music, dancing, why is it so important? She talks about it on page 118. It's because we not only enjoy those when we're feeling joy, but we turn to them when we are sad, lonely, afraid, ashamed, etc. Even embarrassed, you know, embarrassed laughter, you laugh. It helps you shake it off. She writes in here that it's a connection. Laughter, song, and dance reminds us of what truly matters when we're searching for some sort of comfort, celebration, inspiration, or healing. It reminds us that we're not alone.
I think it's because it's an action. It's not words. We can commune and talk and say things to each other, but as far as connecting, words only get you so far.
And these aren't inhibited like words can be.
Right.
Because there's so much meaning attached to it. Sometimes you laugh, you giggle, you chuckle, whatever, right? It's like an overflowing, a release in some way. It's not super controlled. And when you're dancing, I mean, some people want to look cool when they're dancing, you know, you learn ballroom dance, etc. But just dancing silly in your kitchen because it's funny and it feels good and you're having a good time, you're actually enjoying yourself. It's not about what you look like. You're not inhibited.
Right. A freestyle dance is so much more powerful than a regimented ballroom choreographed event.
Right, right. It's not choreographed. She literally says on page 118, she refers to the kind of laughter that helps us heal as a knowing laughter. So when you got off the ropes course and there was this knowing laughter that you all experienced this thing, you weren't alone. Even though you felt terrified and alone for a minute.
Yeah, in the moment.
I'm going to fall.
It's like the fear was your own.
Right. But then the laughter that everybody's experiencing together.
Yep.
The knowing laughter is so healing. She says it's a spiritual form of communing with each other. I'm with you. I get it. That's her quote. Bum, bum, bum. There's so much in this book that's about vulnerability. And she talks about how dancing and singing are like some of the most vulnerable things that you can do.
I tried to out for a solo once in choir. My girls, they learn things about me as they get older. And I tried a lot of different things in high school. One of those was they needed male voices in the choir. So they took pretty much everybody that was willing to volunteer. And I was like, sure, I'll give it a shot. And I kind of have a tenor, but let's just go with untrained. So one of the most amazing teachers ever. So very supportive.
Oh, yeah, I loved him.
And he was like, hey, who would like to try out for a solo for this? So I did. And he gave me the couple bars and I sang it in choir class. And I was like, I knew I was all over the place. As I was singing it, I hadn't practiced. I wasn't hitting the notes right. I could feel it. And no one said anything. And he said, all right, thanks. And no one said anything. Not good job, not thanks, not anything, but also nothing bad.
Not like good try, nothing. Not
nothing. It was just, let's just ignore that happened.
Ooh. And at least an acknowledgement of like, wow, nice try, buddy.
Right.
Would have been like a knowing laughter, but right. not even acknowledging not that it happened.
It was just weird. But I will say the way he handled it, though, I never felt like he belittled me in any way.
Yeah.
He accepted the try and moved on. And so it was one of the most amazing things on how he handled that.
Mm.
Like, I still look at that back as an amazing event. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I was incredibly vulnerable.
Right. You took a leap. Well, and it's moments like that that can inhibit us from being vulnerable again or trying again later, because then now we have that memory. We just assume it's going to be like that every time, right? Interestingly enough, I had the same choir teacher because we went to the same high school. Wah, wah. Wah, wah. I sound like Muppet Babies. Muppet Babies. I tried out for a solo as well in my, what was it, treble choir, which was like all girls. And I could actually sing tenor, so alto range. So I tried out for a solo, and he, like, I wouldn't say teared up, but he was definitely like, oh my gosh, you know, just very kind. Like, that was so great. The girl next to me was like, I almost cried. Like, I didn't think it sounded good at all. Like, you know, I just tried to ignore everybody, and I knew I focused on the one note that I didn't hit right. Oh, I missed that note. You know, somebody else sang it wrong, and then I copied them and I got it wrong too. But their reactions was like, no, it was good. They focused on what went well. Well, here's the thing. I'm not trying to say I'm some fabulous singer. I love the way he handled that. But listen, I tried out for a different solo for graduation. I got the solo. Graduation came. I started singing the solo that was a song that he wrote. So it was a big deal. I sang the first verse. One of the gals in the front row, I won't name her name. She was encouraging. She said, woohoo. Like, yeah. I was so thrown that somebody was enjoying me singing that I blinked on the second half of my solo. I just stood there. And then when the music was finished, I just stepped back to my place. The next person come up and sing their part. But I can see on, there's a home video. I can see on the home video that I turned to the person next to me, my friend. And I'm saying to her, she's trying to sing, but I'm saying, I forgot the words. So you see my mouth moving like that in front of God and everybody. And so talking about the way he handled that, just class.
Right.
Pure class. I didn't hear about it. He didn't like track me down and go, what was that? What happened? You know, here he is debuting his song that he wrote. And it's like this big deal. It's our graduation. Everybody's in their caps and gown. Like, come on, Rebecca. None of that.
Class act.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure that he felt disappointed or whatever. I mean, but nothing that he could have said or done would have made me feel worse. I already felt terrible. And so it wasn't needed. So definitely class act.
Isn't it fun how stories of vulnerability with laughter or song still ring true years later?
They're the best stories.
It's like Brené Brown really understood what she was writing about.
She's a researcher.
Right.
What's up?
So the stuff that she talks about in the singing aspect cracks me up, because I don't know if anyone's experienced watching a silent film, but a silent film without song, without music, without background, anything can be very boring. I grew up, my grandma would tell me about the talkies that her dad played the piano for the sheet music in the background, because they figured out the silent movies were better if somebody was in the area playing the piano to go along with the silent movie, because they didn't have audio back then. So I grew up with that history of knowing that, but I have like late nights sometimes turn on a movie and it's like some old black and white with what's his face, William Shatner, in one of his debut movies, and it's a black and white and it's got no music in the background. It is one of the weirdest movies ever. And I'm just like, wow, or some really old stuff. But nowadays it's a big part of connecting you to film, connecting you to the story.
The music score.
The music score captures is understanding the music and how it moves us emotionally. And to this day, we're still talking about singing moments that still move us emotionally.
So risking that kind of like public humiliation is out of the question for so many people. Like, they would never.
Like, you have to have courage to be vulnerable.
Oh, well, we fall into the questions of like, what are people going to think? Everyone's watching. Calm down. Get a hold of yourself. All these phrases. You know, most people aren't raised with like, sure, go ahead, dance. Be loud.
Well, I think it's when and she talks about this on 123, when we value being cool or being in control for ourselves, it comes through in what we value for others. So we don't cultivate in ourselves song and dance and laughter, and then we control it in others, or our concern over perceptions of how others perceive us as cool or in control. It takes a lot of guts to get out there on stage. It takes a lot of guts to try something new and to be on a field, to be vulnerable. And it's like we're helping our kids experience and figure out and helping them face that with a courageous spirit instead of trying to tell them to be cool or hold on to like control, like do what you can control. It's no, we need to push the envelope and we need to jump in and just enjoy it.
I like how she says it, that when we don't give ourselves permission to be free, we rarely tolerate that freedom in other people. So your restrictiveness in your own life trickles to others, to your spouse, partner, children, even friends, siblings.
Well, and I think it, like going back to the guidepost we've been talking about, it trickle into your meaningful work. It'll trickle into
right,
like your calm and your stillness. Like it's going to inhibit you from having that wholehearted life.
Yeah, she says betrayal is an important word with this particular guidepost, because when we're valuing being in control over valuing heartfelt, soulful expressions, being silly, playful, we're creating that imbalance and we're betraying ourselves.
I don't know what else to say.
Well, she talks about getting deep. So if you believe that song and dance and laughing is essential to your soul care, like literally your soul needs these things, how do you make sure that you hold space for that in your life? What's your actionable steps? Turn on the music when you're cooking. That helps. That helps me get out of the rut of like, oh, I have to make another meal for these people that won't even like it. I put on music. It's such a powerful tool.
The kids like it when I roll down the windows in the truck and we're driving with the music turned up so they can bang their heads and sing along to whatever's
rock and roll
yeah, or pop song is coming on.
Our youngest is all excited about Bon Jovi. She likes Bon Jovi Pandora radio station. An actionable idea is to make a playlist that's yours. Your favorite songs, the songs that you have to sing to, that you have to dance to. When you're sad, you can use it as a healing balm. Oh, use music to help you. Sometimes James just dances with me randomly in the house and we let our kids see that.
Yeah, right now they go, ooh, every time we kiss. Ooh. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's letting them see it's okay. Letting them see good and bad. Letting them see our vulnerability. And I can tell that they're looking for what makes dad laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what is dad amused by?
That's one of my most favorite things. I should write that down in my meaningful work. How can I get people to laugh? I don't want to say I'm a comic, but I like making people laugh. I had somebody ask me recently, like, why do you laugh at everything? Like, it's not funny. Why are you making a joke out of everything? I'm like, it's not a joke. I like to find the funny in things because life is too serious. So if something is awkward, it's like, yeah, that's cringeworthy. But oh my word, if I don't laugh about it. Because otherwise, what do? Like, you know? So the dare is to just be goofy.
Which he's my favorite Disney character. So I think I can embody that.
Wholehearted living in general is about living in a place of worthiness. She writes that on page 125.
And I would add that, because I have that underlined as well, but I would add that the truth is that meaningful change is a process.
I put brackets around the next part about the three C's, the courage, compassion, and connection. Cultivating those three C's, and that I put a bracket around no matter what gets done, how much is left undone, I am enough, like regardless of what. And I said that we belong on our love lists, warts and all, mistakes and all. we get to take a seat at the table. Take a seat at the table, okay? Because guess what? It's your table. You belong there. Mic drop. You guys, we have new microphones. Hopefully, listeners can tell. We have a new soundboard. I'm playing with levels. Hopefully, it will sound better. And our editing speed
will get better.
We'll get better. Hopefully, I'll be able to edit in way less time. Because it normally takes like 4 hours to edit one podcast. This is a lot of time put in. And if you guys haven't figured it out, I'm a busy lady. So doing all of that is taxing sometimes. I enjoy it, but I just need the time to sit down and do that. Eventually, it'd be great to, you know, have the podcast have enough supporters that it would sustain itself, and then it could hire somebody else to do the editing. So we would just have to sit down and talk and record. That'd be fabulous. But until that point, I do it myself.
It takes a lot of effort to make me sound good.
Hero. Okay, so the wrapping up here at the back of the book, she talks about how we need to stop pretending that everything is okay when it isn't, right? And your survival response is not the only response that you have to be stuck in. So we are going to start recognizing our triggers and our anxieties, right? We're going to create some calm and stillness so that we can dream and cultivate meaningful work in our lives, right? So we can live wholeheartedly. And Brené says, brave, afraid, and very, very alive, just like Mark Twain, right? My last final thoughts in here were to watch out, especially for women, because we minimize a lot. We say it's fine, right? Which is untrue, which can create a seed of like resentment and hurt. And it's pain because it's a lie, right? And what that lie means is that I'm not worthy enough to have something actually be wrong. You don't think you're worthy enough to have something be wrong. And why is that? What are you afraid of? Well, if something's wrong, will people leave? If something's wrong, will you not get the help that you need? Do you think it's weak to ask for help? So instead, you stay small, you serve with love. Serve everybody else because everything will be fine. Well, that's a lie. How do you combat a lie? Well, with truth. So the truth is love, okay, is honest. Love works it out. Love is patient. And here's this kicker. The father of love is God. The father of lies is Satan. You have to choose your father wisely. But don't ever forget that love tries again. So with this whole book, this wholehearted living, being brave, afraid, very alive, it's love in all the aspects of it. It's putting yourself on your love list and sitting down at your table and knowing that you're worthy of that. Pull up a chair. Okay. Any final trivia?
Only when it's meaningless.
It's like almost 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
I don't even know what we said.
Nope.
But I will edit it. And hopefully it will turn out okay. And it's being vulnerable.
It's being vulnerable. We're throwing some content out there. Just seeing what sticks. Well, next time can we do more comfortable chairs? Because these suck. Things we do to ourselves.
So we've upgraded to a soundboard and better mics, but we still just have fold out metal chairs that we're sitting in. So yes. It would be really nice. Well, they're quiet.
They
don't creak. But they're not very comfortable.
I'm just like, other podcasts have resolved this.
You need a cushy cush chair.
Yeah. I'm getting old.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I think that's a wrap.
Okay.
Good job, babe.
Did you just stop the recording?
Oh. No, I really like, and we have headphones, so we can finally hear ourselves in our headphones instead of me just hearing what it sounds like when I go to play it back.
Right.
Which is awesome.
It is pretty cool.